Well, it's good to be back here. I notice you always have these leadership meetings when I'm out of town, so. Yeah, very good. So.
Your representatives are here, so.
That's right. Just coincidence, doing a lot of travel this fall. Probably the most travel I've ever done in the fall. But I'm glad to be with you, and I'll be with you at least for all of December and the last couple of weeks. Well, at least 1 week in November, if not 2 weeks. But I will be missing next week because we'll be doing a major event at the University of Missouri and the churches in that area. It was fun celebrating Halloween. I did an experiment this year where we had, candy, but I made careful it wasn't just sugar candy. You know, try to get some nuts in it or whatever. And then had some broccoli for us to go with it, too. And what I noticed is, when the mothers come up with their little ones, they always point to the broccoli. Take that. But when they come up by themselves, the broccoli stays there. So,
yeah.
But hey, I know someone who's actually even more mean-spirited than that. I got a dentist friend who hands out toothbrushes and dental floss. So.
Follow their ID.
Oh, good for you. All right.
Not just you can, but broccoli and all.
Oh, good for you. Okay, well, we're moving into the Thanksgiving season, and there's some new discoveries I want to share with you. And it basically, I'm known for thanking God for weird things, like sulfate-reducing bacteria. I'm actually doing some specials on KKLA where we're talking about what we really should be thankful for. There's four things I wanted to discuss this morning. How we need to be thankful for Earth's density, thankful for carbon and just the unique carbon abundance we have here on planet Earth. And given that we're moving into Thanksgiving and Christmas, that we should especially thank God for a whole new set of papers that just got published on gut bacteria. I mean, what other church are you going to hear about gut bacteria on Sunday morning, right?
Yeah.
But it's an amazing discovery and probably something that you, Richard, are aware of. It just got published in Nature a couple of weeks ago, and then we're going to get into the theme of this class, which is looking at the water cycle and how God has designed that. And we've been looking at how we've been blessed with snow and with frost, and how God has designed it so that we get the benefit of frozen precipitation virtually over the whole planet. What we're going to go this morning is thanking God for sheets of ice. I mean, your life depends, our civilization depends on sheets of ice. So we're going to talk about sheets of ice on the land and sheets of ice in the ocean, both of which are mentioned in Job 37 and 38. And remember that time we had in the class where we went through, well, it's the latter part of Job 36, all of 37, first part of Job 38, where it talks about the water cycle and how there were 16 different features that you found in those chapters about our water cycle and how each of those 16 plays a role in making it possible for us human beings to launch and sustain global civilization. So yeah, today we're going to thank God for glaciers. But first of all, the density. And the reason why I'm talking about this is not just because it's a cool discovery, but it's really hit the news. And I counted about 30 web articles on what's called Kepler 78b. It's a planet that was discovered by the Kepler satellite. And what's driving all the excitement, it's the first planet that's been discovered outside the solar system that has roughly the same size as the Earth and the same density as the Earth. So Earth-like, this is the most Earth-like planet that's been found so far. Well, Earth-like in quotes. Yes, it does have approximately the same diameter as the Earth and the same density as the Earth. But it's extremely hot. In fact, they refer to it as a lava planet. How hot are we talking? The surface temperature is 3,600 degrees Fahrenheit. So it's warm. Warm enough that, even the metals on the planet would be in a liquid state.
What's the name of it?
The name of it is Kepler 78b.
Oh.
Okay, great name, all right? So, well, it's better than HD and a six-figure number, which is typically how they refer to these things. It's basically the 78th star planet system that's been discovered by the Kepler satellite. That's how they come up with the name. And one of the unique features of this planet, it's got the fastest revolution period yet discovered. We're talking 8.5 hours. That's how long its year is. So its year is actually about 1/3 of our day. And that's what's really got the astronomers excited, not that they, quote, found an Earth-like planet. That's what's all over the web. But if you actually read the... It's been published in the latest issue of Nature, and what's driving the excitement of the scientists is why does this planet even exist? Because given that it is so small and so close to its star, it should have been sucked into the star long ago. And yet, what we've been able to observe in terms of its orbit, it will get sucked into its star. It's too close for it to survive. However, they calculate it's going to be 3 billion years before it gets sucked into its star. So it's in a relatively stable orbit. And that's the mystery. Why is it in such a stable orbit? Well, one answer would be that's where it formed. But it's impossible for a planet that size to form that close to its star. Why? Because when a star is young, it's orbiting a G-type star, very roughly the same size as our star, the Sun. And G-type stars, when they're young, are much bigger than they are when they're middle-aged. So our Sun was once a lot bigger than it is now. And the problem is, if this planet formed with its star, it would have formed inside the star, which means it would have been incinerated. So clearly it didn't form inside the star. And astronomers are well aware that if you got lots of asteroids and comets in the planetary system, the planets will drift. And depending on the characteristics of those asteroids and comets, they'll drift outward, which was the case of Jupiter and Saturn. They experience an outward drift, but far more commonly what we observe is an inward drift. And so we see lots of what we call hot Jupiters in these extrasolar planetary catalogs. That is, planets the size of Jupiter and Saturn that are orbiting very close to their star, a place where we know they can't form, but they drift inwards. And so that was kind of the explanation here. This planet drifted inwards. But all the drift models tell us if a planet's that small, it won't drift and stabilize. It'll just drift all the way in and be gobbled up by its star. And clearly that didn't happen. What does that mean? It means our models for planetary drift are not sophisticated enough to explain this particular event. Now, obvious explanations. We've only discovered one planet in the system so far, but if you've got other planets or very large asteroids in the system, that could complicate the picture enough where the drift would be interrupted. And so that's one explanation for why it's so close to its star, but is actually having an orbit that's going to remain roughly stable for a few billion years. But that's something that astronomers are still trying to work out, okay? We need a more sophisticated planet drift model that includes the gravitational interactions of the asteroidal belt and other planets that might be in the system. The problem with this system is they've only discovered one planet in it so far. Yes?
A young Earth creationist might use this as a supporting argument.
Oh, definitely. They've already jumped on it. So yeah, that's they'll say this is proof that old Earth creationists don't know what they're doing. Well, what the paper really points out is our models for planetary drift are too simple to explain this one incident. Clearly, it must have drifted into the position and somehow stabilized. The drift is not the issue. Why did the drift stop and you get a relatively stable orbit about this star when the star is roughly middle age? That's the thing. But that's what's got the scientific community excited. They'd never considered that problem before. They're now developing computer models that are targeting that very problem. So that's kind of what's got the scientific community excited. What's got the lay web audience excited is this is the most Earth-like planet we've found so far. And that's one comment I'll make on it is the excitement is it's got the same density. Well, just to give you an idea, Earth's density, if you include the entire planet, is 5.515 grams per cubic centimeter, where water is 1 gram per cubic centimeter. So the Earth is roughly a little more than 5 times denser than water. And our planet is the densest planet in our solar system. Now, that is an enigma. Earth should not be the densest planet in our solar system. the density of planets depends on the size of the planet. The smaller the planet, the denser it will be, and also depends on how far away it is from its star. Why? Because when it's close to its star, the heat of the star will blow away the light stuff. So, for example, Mercury is much denser than Venus, and Venus is denser than Mars. Just because that, you know, Venus is farther away from the Sun than Mercury is, and Mars is farther away than Venus. Just to give you the numbers, Mercury has a density of 5.427, so it's almost as dense as the Earth. Venus is 5.243, a little less dense. Say, how come they're so close? Well, Venus is bigger, and it's farther away from the Sun. Mars is 3.933, so it's considerably less dense than Venus or Mercury. Why? It's far enough away where the heat of the Sun is not going to drive off as many of the light components as would be the case for Mercury and Venus. But the enigma is Earth. We're far away from the Sun, and yet we've got the higher density than Mercury. I mean, the smaller the planet, the denser it should be. The closer it is to its star, the denser it should be. Well, I mean, here's the Earth, far denser than Mercury, or far bigger than Mercury, and much farther away, and yet it's got a great density. Well, we know why. It's because the Earth experienced a collision event with a planet about twice the mass of Mars when it was between 30 and 50 million years old, and also had a reshaping of its internal density in what's called the late heavy bombardment, which took place about 700 million years ago. And that late heavy bombardment blasted the Earth with 30 times the damage that the Moon experienced. When you look at the Moon tonight and see all those craters on the Moon, over 90% of them formed during this late heavy bombardment event. And Earth took 30 times the damage that the Moon took. So we really got hit hard. And being the most massive of the inner solar system planets, we took the heaviest hit, but also experienced the greatest transformation. So that roughly explains why we're so dense.
Is that part of the creation process?
I would argue that that was part of the creation process. You can read about that by going to our website, where I have a series of six articles on the first billion years of the history of the solar system, and there's about a half dozen events like this that require extraordinary fine-tuning to explain why we wind up with a big rocky planet as far away from its star as it is, with the enormous density that it has. So the fact that this newly discovered planet has a density, its density, by the way, it varies a bit, because what you see in the latest issue of Nature is two different research teams published their measurements on this planet, and they got slightly different results. One said that the mass of the planet was 1.69 times greater than the Earth. The other said it was 1.86 times. Why? Because the diameter of the planet was difficult to measure. It's roughly about 20% bigger than our planet. So it comes in at about 9,200 miles across as opposed to 7,900 miles across for planet Earth. So it's slightly bigger. But because of the error bars, there's these competing measurements. But its density comes in between 0.96 and 1.01. So 96% to 101% is kind of the range on the density of the Earth. Yeah, it literally is the first extrasolar planet we have found that has approximately the same density as the Earth. On the other hand, given that it must have drifted into its current position, it must have started off with a density that's way below the Earth. Because as it comes in that close to the Sun or its star, its star, Kepler 78, would have basically blown off all the light stuff. So as the planet comes in towards the star, its density is going to increase. And especially given that it's orbiting so close to its star, it's orbiting 40 times closer to its star than Mercury orbits our star. So that's how close it is. In fact, it's so close that if you're on the surface of this planet, looking up at the sky at noon, the star would cover about 50 degrees across the sky. So it would be 100 times bigger in across the sky in terms of its angular diameter than we see with our own Sun. So you can imagine what it would be like on the surface of that planet. But for that very reason, I'm surprised that its density is low as it is. I was expecting the density to come in much higher. For example, we have found other planets that are small, a couple of times bigger than the Earth, that are orbiting its star quite a bit further away than this particular example, where the density is 8 grams per cubic centimeter. And that's about right. I would expect that for a big rocky planet coming within a few million miles of its star. This one is a lot lower. So to me, the mystery is, why is the density so low? But there again is an opportunity for further research. We need a more sophisticated drift model to explain how it is this planet got so close and yet retains a relatively stable orbit, and why its density is as low as it is. So the fact that it has the same density as the Earth, I basically see that as having no consequence in terms of design or theology, yes.
Well, the surprise that the density is greater, I mean, doesn't that go back to the idea that you have to assume that that planet was formed out of a nebula similar to the nebula that the Earth was formed out of? And do we have reason to believe that?
We don't. I mean, for example, we do know that the solar system planets are denser than the typical exoplanets we're discovering. Why? Because the Sun formed in a star cluster where it was bathed in a lot of short-lived, very hot radiometric isotopes, which basically blasted away a lot of the light stuff. For example, Earth has 1,200 times less carbon than it should have. Why does that have so little carbon? Because when the solar system was forming, it was being blasted by this radiation that drove off all the light stuff. So our rocky planets tend to be denser than what we're seeing in other extrasolar planetary systems. So that's kind of where people are going to go to explain the density of this planet. I mean, so far we've only found one planet in that system. If we were to find a couple of others, it would really help the model development. And in fact, that's one comment that was made by the researchers. The fact that we have a star, all we really know about the star is it's a G-type star. We don't have an accurate measure of its age or even very precisely its spectral type. And therefore, we don't know as much about the star as we need to know. And we've only got this one planet where we've got some significant error bars on it. How can you build a model? And so basically what the researchers are saying, we're going to have to find other examples like this, or we're going to have to find another planet in the same system before we can make any headway on building a model. But they are recognizing this is an enigma that's not fitting in what we see from other extrasolar planets.
Well, doesn't that speak maybe to the fact that we need more data?
Definitely.
Rather than the model. The model is based on gravitational effects, so the model itself may be okay, but the data may be wrong.
Well, what typically astronomers do, they work both ends against the middle. So what's happening as a result of this paper is you've got observers saying, we need more data. But the researchers aren't going to wait for the data. They're going to say, you know, let's build a more sophisticated model and see what possibilities we get in anticipation of the data. And my friends who are theoretical astrophysicists, that's typically how they operate. They always like to be ahead of the observers and kind of lay out, say, 6 or 8 different scenarios. And then when the observations come in, they say, this one fits. This is the explanation. This is where we need to go to build an even more sophisticated model. So other disciplines don't work that way, but astronomy, which is always data hungry, has been operating that way for a good 100 years.
And how? What's the margin of error?
Well, in this particular case, the margin of error on the density was between 96% to 101%. So that's... And that's just based on the problems they have trying to measure the diameter of the planet. Back in the corner there.
This new planet that's supposed to look like our Earth, is very close to their own sun. Do you know anything about that? Can you make a comment on that?
Well, this is the very thing we're talking about. Yeah, this is the discovery.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. It was announced on Friday in the scientific literature, and I got up this morning and discovered there was about 60 articles on the web on this. So it's really getting a lot of attention, and that's kind of why I brought it here, because I want you to be ready to talk about it when this comes up at work.
I got my hand up one time.
Okay.
A quick question. Is there any remote chance that this was captured? Can a planet this size actually leave one solar system to be captured by another one? Is that a remote possibility?
That's a very, very low possibility.
But it is possible.
It's possible, but very low. Reason why is, for example, we have the gas giants in our solar system that have captured moons. But the closer you get to the star, the lower the probability a capture will be successful. So, for example, we wouldn't expect any of the rocky planets in our solar system to have captured moons. They're just too close to the sun for that to be dynamically possible. And this thing's extremely close. So,
yeah, but if it was captured and then brought in, that would explain the closeness. I mean, if it comes at the right angle and the right speed, it could be captured and then it would drift in.
But it's an extremely low probability that it would be captured into a stable orbit. And the most likely possibility is it gets scattered out. The second most probable situation is it gets sucked into the star. And when it's that close, we're talking probabilities way below a millionth, one part in a million. I don't know what the probability is, but I'm certain it's below that for a successful capture that close. I don't know which of you two were first, so. All right.
Have you heard of these, I think I read where there's some orphan stars out there that don't orbit around a star. Have you heard about that?
Orphan planets, yes. Well,
what's the stable orbit anyhow?
Well, a stable orbit is where a planet is able to orbit about its star for at least a billion years without being kicked out or sucked into its star. That's what we call a semi-stable orbit. And in this case, we know that this thing is going to be safely outside of its star for 3 billion years. And say, why 3 billion years? Well, 3 billion years from now, we know the star is going to grow, expand enough to engulf the planet, and that'll be bye-bye planet. By the way, that's eventually going to happen to our Earth, is that our sun will eventually get big enough that it'll engulf the entire orbit of the Earth. And so we will get incinerated.
When will that be?
Well, if you're planning your event schedule, it will happen 4.5 billion years from now. So, it's not going to affect your vacation plans. Yes.
My understanding of Kepler is they're mainly interested in Earth-like planets that can support life.
Right.
But since there doesn't seem to me, at first blush, to be any possibility of that on this planet, on this one they found because it's a little toasty, so they shifted their interests to planet formation. But if that's the case, I don't understand their interest in its size and density.
Well, their interest is basically the next step. Can we really find a truly Earth-like planet?
Right.
A planet the size of the Earth, roughly the density of the Earth, roughly the same distance from its star. Not necessarily a life support planet, but maybe at least a water world. So that's kind of the goal. And what research on this particular planet, because its diameter is just very slightly larger than the Earth, they were able to compare the two different studies and say, what's the realistic possibility we're going to be able to use Kepler or an instrument like Kepler to find a real Goldilocks planet, a planet that could have liquid water on its surface. And it was quite discouraging, namely that it will only be possible if a planet happens to be orbiting a star that has the same luminosity stability as our star, the Sun. Because here's the problem. They're detecting these planets by the dimming of the light as a planet passes between us and its star. But all stars have a level of variability. And so the detection of the planet has got to be discoverable from the noise of the variation in the star's luminosity. And we're talking planets as small as the Earth. This is what they've discovered, is that typically the variability in the luminosity of the star is going to overwhelm the signal of the dimming of the lights, star's light by a planet the size of Earth passing between it and us.
So then they look for regularity?
Well, they look for regularity, which means you need to have repeated observations. And also you get a slightly different light dimming signature when the planet is entering what's called the limb. So you know, say here's the diameter of the star, and when the planet comes towards the edge of the star and our observing position, it won't dim as much as when it's right, say, in the center of the star's disk. And so they kind of look for the signature of the dropping of the light and then the light coming back up. But if you've got a star that's varying, like typical solar-like stars do vary, you will not be able to pull the signal out. That's kind of the discouraging news from this study.
Well, it was pretty ambitious to begin with.
It was pretty ambitious to begin with, but the exciting thing, again, for the observers is finally we've got a planet that's approximately the same diameter as the Earth. Let's see what our detectability limits are here. And they were a little bit discouraged that the detectability limits aren't as good as what we had presumed. Now, the way out is that we can find a star with planets where the star has the same luminosity stability as the Sun. But we already know the Sun is at the very top limit of what you're going to get in luminosity stability. And so we have yet to find a star that has that luminosity stability characteristic. And as I've shared here in the class, we know from detailed studies of the Sun that our Sun sustains maximum luminosity stability for only 100,000 years, which began about 50,000 years ago. So another 50,000 years from now, our Sun isn't going to be as stable as it is now. And that's one reason why we have the Creator putting human beings on planet Earth at the time that He did. One of many reasons is that you want to be here when the Sun has its maximum luminosity stability. But we also know from detailed models of stars, you're going to get that maximum luminosity stability when the star is almost perfectly middle-aged. And that's the case of our star, the Sun. It's gone through half of its nuclear energy supply. So it's almost, well, it is as closely middle-aged as we can measure. We know it's going to burn for a little more than 9 billion years, and it's 4.57 billion years old. So we're right at the halfway point. But when you're right at the halfway point is where we get that luminosity stability. Now, we only have a sample size of one. Because of how close our star is, we can develop very detailed theoretical models for its history. We don't know whether that's going to be reflected in other stars. So that's another research enterprise going. So, but all this is going to factor into how easy it's going to be to find small planets like the Earth. Now,
and you're not holding your breath for them to hit Hader.
Well, it's probably going to require another satellite being sent up that's got much greater capability than Kepler. That's probably what it's going to take. And right now, NASA is facing considerable funding cuts. So. Whether that's going to happen?
Can private companies do that?
Well, they could, but it is a fairly expensive venture. So, yeah, if you want to pass the plate around here.
A foreign country is better than ours.
Well, that could happen, too. Maybe the Chinese will take up this project.
Not too many commercial
Not
too many commercial payoffs.
Not too many commercial payoffs. It's mainly a curiosity of humanity kind of thing, which is, hey, what? That's what funds astronomy, right? On the other hand, astronomers at least can claim that we've had some benefit for society. It was astronomy that paved the way for the atomic bomb and the hydrogen bomb. You say, wow, is that a positive thing? Well, bombs always come before power stations. And it was the development of the atomic bomb that led to the development of nuclear reactors. And now I have a group of friends that are working on in plasma physics research labs that are trying to capture the physics of the hydrogen bomb and actually build a power station. And I remember 50 years ago, my professors telling me we're 50 years away from having a commercially viable nuclear fusion reactor. And today they're saying they're 50 years away from having commercially viable. So
I go back farther than you, and I was 20 years at that time.
Well, I remember my plasma physics professor being very optimistic in the 1960s about how soon we're going to be there. I mean, they've actually built nuclear fusion reactors where they get as much nuclear energy out as they put in. But, I mean, you want to get a little more out than what you put in. And what they're really doing now is trying to raise the money to scale up, because in nuclear fusion, you get more payoff the bigger you make the fusion reactor. So there may come a day when we get virtually all of our power from the same power that fires up the sun. Potentially the payoff is huge. You could get a huge amount of power for very little expense. Could lower your utility bills, but basically it all requires building, really big, stable magnetic bottles. And that's not an easy thing to do. Easy for the sun, because it uses gravity, but you clearly can't develop enough gravity to make it work here on Earth. You've got to use either laser beams or magnets or a combination of the two. Okay, let me segue to another thing you need to be thankful for. And by the way, why should we be thankful for the Earth's density? It's because of the Earth's density, we have the ingredients we need for advanced life. Let me just kind of pull this up here for you. Here we go. Because we have a very high density, we got more phosphorus than we should have. And phosphorus is a key ingredient in the DNA and the RNA. It's also a key ingredient in the molecules that make possible energy sources in the human body. We have 50 times more fluorine. So, when you're eating all that... I'm thinking about when you're eating all that...
Broccoli.
That's right, thank you. I was thinking about the Halloween candy. They're going to be thankful for all this fluorine that we have. We have 60 times less sulfur, 1,200 times less carbon, and 2,400 times less nitrogen. But then look at all these valuable metals we have, thanks to our high density. We got aluminum, titanium, lots of iron, and huge amounts of uranium and thorium compared to what we'd expect in other rocky planets. And let me go back to this carbon issue here. See if I can pull this... Come back here. Here we go. This just came out on October 29th and also is going to be published in the Astrophysical Journal, but this was an announcement made at the American Astronomical Society where, there's been this push. Let's look for planets where there's water and there's carbon. Carbon is critical for life. We're all carbon-based. Life can only be built on carbon. But a group of researchers, theoreticians, basically modeled what happens when you've got a carbon-rich planetary system. And what they discovered is when you've got a carbon-rich planetary system, what happens is that carbon will grab the oxygen more strongly than the hydrogen will. And so we got lots of carbon, you wind up with carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide, and you don't have any water. And all their models showed that if you get significantly more carbon than we see in our own solar system, you're not going to have any water. And so their point is that these extrasolar planets we're discovering, they're carbon worlds, but they're not water worlds. And where we do find water worlds, the water is coming in at way too high in abundance. Somewhere in the neighborhood of 500 times as much water as we see here on the Earth. Keep in mind, however, we do have water worlds in the solar system. The moons of Jupiter and Saturn, for example, many of them have more than 25% water content. By comparison, our planet is less than 0.03% water. So when you look at Europa, that's 35% water, and I think it's Ganymede that's 65% water. Callisto is very high water content. The comets are 80 to 85% water. So once you get past what's called the snow line in our planetary system, you've got lots of water. The snow line is where you get water in a frozen state, and that's where you get the gas giants, because if the gases freeze, you're going to get big planets. If the gases don't freeze, then the heat of the sun will blast them off and they will not settle. But the fact that we have so little carbon explains why it's possible we can have a big rocky planet with lots of water on it. Also explains why we can breathe.
Europa, is that where we get the name Europe from?
No, that's not where we got the name Europe from. Europa was named much later, and it's a Greek term. Yeah, where was I going with this? Okay.
Broccoli,
broccoli, yeah, that's right. No.
Broccoli needs water.
But what it's telling us is that you're typically going to get a lot of water or a lot of carbon, but what's going to be extremely rare is to get a planet that's carbon poor and water poor, which is what you need to have advanced life on a planet. We need liquid water on its surface. We need a very thin layer of liquid water on its surface. And that planet also has to be hyper-enriched with uranium and thorium. Otherwise, you'll not get a planet with continents and oceans together. In fact, many of my colleagues that are involved in the search for extrasolar planets are saying, we think Earth is the only planet that will ever be found where you've got oceans and continents together on its surface in a stable fashion. And that's just because of what we're discovering about the chemistry. So when you celebrate Thanksgiving, you might want to thank God for the fact that we live on a planet that's extremely carbon poor and also water poor at the same time. On the other hand, what this paper is pointing out, you can get a planet that has no carbon at all. You can get a planet that has no water at all. That's possible. Or you can get a planet that's got lots of carbon and no water. Or you can get a planet that has lots of water and very little carbon. What they don't know how to do is how you get a planet that has very little water and very little carbon so that you can have a planet with oceans and continents. And when I say they don't know, they already do know.
Can you have a planet with lots of water and lots of carbon?
No. That's what this paper is pointing out. If you got lots of carbon, you're not going to have water. You're not going to have any water. Why? Because the carbon is going to be much, the oxygen will be much more powerfully attracted to the carbon molecules than it will the hydrogen molecules. So basically, there won't be any oxygen around for the hydrogen to bond to, which is why they're going to be totally, they say, not only dry, they're going to be waterless. There won't be any water at all in that case. And when I say we don't know about the Earth, well, we do know. It takes this extraordinarily fine-tuned collision event where you've got this planet twice the size of Mars sharing the same orbit of the Earth, gradually creeping towards the Earth and hitting the Earth in a low-velocity collision event at a particular attack angle in an ocean of the just right depth, and then followed by the late heavy bombardment. Also, you need the solar system to be born in just the right kind of star cluster and kicked out from the star cluster at just the right time and at just the right location. As I said, you know, go to the articles we have on the website. There's actually six different features of the history of the first billion years that must be fine-tuned in order for us to have the carbon-water ratio that we do, including something that was just newly discovered, and you've got to read about it. It's called the jumping Jupiter effect. If you don't have a jumping Jupiter, you're not going to have the kind of planet like Earth on which advanced life is possible. I won't go into the technical details. It is pretty technical, but go ahead.
Was Earth's orbit about the same when the collision event occurred? So was it further out?
Yes.
Did we drift at all?
Earth probably did not drift at all. Now, its orbit may have changed slightly as Jupiter and Saturn were migrating out, but it would have been a very slight change. And the two planets were sharing exactly the same orbit.
Were those gas planets going past the Earth? Or
no, no. Okay. Gas giants can only form beyond what's called the snow line. So that would be the snow line in our solar system is it's between Mars and Jupiter, where these gases will always be in a frozen state, and it's a little bit closer to Jupiter than it is to Mars. So that's kind of the line where you're going to get gas giants forming. Anything interior to that will be rocky. Anything exterior to that will be a gas giant. So that explains why the planets beyond that snow line are all gas giants and the planets interior are all rocky. What this paper is pointing out is that if you've got a lot of carbon in the system, there will be no snow line. There'll be no place where water can form, either as a vapor or in a frozen state, because there won't be the oxygen around to bind to the carbon. So you're going to get very different looking gas giant planets, which explains a lot of the characteristics of these extrasolar planets that we're finding, because the Jupiter-like planets are not very Jupiter-like. And the reason being is they got way more carbon than we see in the gas giants in our planetary system. Yes?
When you say that the radioactive elements are necessary to plate tectonics, also in the past you've said that they are the primary source of heat for liquefying the core. So does that mean that normally a planet would have a rocky hard core instead of liquid, and therefore no dynamo effect of that kind of thing?
Well, the rule of thumb is that your plate tectonic activity in a rocky planet will go up as the mass of the planet goes up, because that's going to generate enough density and heat in the interior to drive the plate tectonics. The enigma of planet Earth is that it's a small rocky planet, relatively speaking, and yet it's got this powerful magnetic field, stable and powerful stable plate tectonics. That shouldn't be. The reason it is that we are hyper-enriched in uranium and thorium. So it's not something we would expect. But yeah, we would expect, say, a rocky planet that's twice the mass of the Earth will have more plate tectonic activity than, say, a planet the size of Mars or Venus. Mars and Venus did exhibit some plate tectonic activity, but it was short-lived and not nearly at the level that we see on the Earth. The amazing thing about the Earth is it's stable. It doesn't go up and down. It's relatively stable, and it's very long-lasting. But it's because we have, as this table shows here, 340 times, let me get the numbers up here for you. Here we go. Uranium, we're 340 times more abundant than we should be. And with thorium, we're 610 times more abundant than we should be. So we have a lot of that stuff. And so, by the way, if you're living here in California, you've got more uranium and thorium in your vegetables than you would if you were living in some other part of the world. And and I've also heard that that's calculates into the fact that our lifespan's roughly 1 month shorter than it would be in places that don't have soil so heavily enriched in uranium. Well, there's other states in the 48 states where the thorium abundance is much higher than here in California. Hey, don't worry about it. It's only a month. Yeah.
These abundances, is that applying to our solar system or to Earth in particular?
Okay. What these numbers are the quantity of uranium relative to magnesium that we see in our galaxy compared to what we see in the crust of the Earth. Okay? The interior of the Earth is going to be more uranium and thorium rich than the crust, but these are figures for the crust because those are things that we can actually measure. And the reason why we compare it to magnesium is it's a heavy enough element that is going to be retained without loss by a rocky planet. Whereas if we were to compare these elements to, say, hydrogen or helium, well, if you've got a rocky planet, all this stuff is gone. And so the ratios will all be, close to infinity. So yeah, we need to find a ratio that's going to work for rocky planets. So that's why I'm saying this is how much richer we are in these elements compared to magnesium than what we'd expect to see in rocky planets elsewhere in the universe or our galaxy. It doesn't really make any difference whether you compare it to the galaxy or the universe. But these figures are compared to our galaxy. Okay, let me segue to something that's not astrophysics. And this is really in Rich's area of expertise, so Rich, feel free to jump in. You've probably read these articles. So three articles that got published in Nature a few weeks back. And, given that we're heading into Thanksgiving and Christmas, we really need to be careful to feed our microbiome and not so much our bodies. Okay, you've heard Buzz say in podcasts, there's more bacteria in and on the human body than there are cells that make up our human body. So, something to think about. But we have a lot of bacteria in our gut. And it's because of those bacteria in our gut, these papers were published in Nature basically pointing out that your gut bacteria really factor heavily into your health and well-being. And that what might be good for you, what you think is good for you, may not necessarily be good for the bacteria in your gut. And so what this study did, this was done in Denmark and in France, two different studies. And what they did in France, or pardon me, Denmark, is they recruited 292 people that were willing to have their gut bacteria analyzed. Okay, and they picked, I think it was, 92 of them were classified as lean. There was another group classified as overweight, another group classified as obese. And you say, how did they come up with the categories? Well, you've probably heard of something called the body mass index. Okay, and your body mass index is basically your height in meters divided by your weight in kilograms squared. Or is it, pardon me, it's the other way around. It's your weight in kilograms divided by your height in meters squared. You say, why do they use those units? Well, it's because they came up with this in Europe. So it's going to be meters and kilograms. But for example, you're considered to be of normal weight if your body mass index is 25. If it's less than 25, you're considered to be lean. And if it's between 25 and 30, you're considered to be overweight. And if it's over 30, you're considered to be obese. Now, because they're dividing by the square of the height, just a small change in the body mass index actually translates into a significant change in your weight. So you might say, well, gee, there's not much difference between 26 and 25. There really is a big difference between 25 and a 26. But what they did with this group is they analyzed these three groups, and then they measured the gene count in their gut bacteria, which basically reflects how many species of gut bacteria they have and the abundance levels of those gut bacteria. And they basically classified people as having a low gene bacterial gut count and those that had a high gut bacterial count. And what they noticed is with lean people, they're heavily pushed over into what's called the high gene count level. So those who are, quote, lean, almost all of them have a very high gene count. Whereas those that are obese fall into two categories. This is what they weren't expecting. There's one group that has a high gene count. There's a second group that has a low gene count. And you can actually look at the paper. It's kind of bimodal. It shows a population statistic like this. That's the low gene count. Then it goes up and they got another one with a high gene count. And they said, well, let's actually compare the low gene count to the high gene count and see what happens with these individuals. And they monitored them for 9 years. And what they discovered is those who had a low gene count gained weight at a higher rate than those that had a high gene count. So they kind of concluded the first of their papers by saying, all right, a high gene count actually helps you not gain weight as rapidly. Now, I'll tell you what was really interesting. They didn't just focus on the obese people. They went after the lean people, too. And what discovered is that lean people who have a high gene count, they basically maintain their weight. But those with a low gene count lose weight over time. So you become leaner and leaner over time as you get older and older if you've got a low gene count as a lean person. And so they basically concluded their paper, a high gene count really helps stabilize your weight. So if you're on the lean side, which means a body mass index of less than 25, you really want to try to boost your high gene count up so to keep you from losing weight over time. Whereas if you're kind of on the heavy side, also you notice, by the way, those with a low gene count over a 9-year period saw their body mass index go up by 2.6 in 9 years. And that's a lot of weight gain. Whereas those who had a high gene count, it only went up by 1.6. That's still quite a bit of weight gain, but it's a whole lot less than those who had the low gene count. Now, that led to another research study. And this time they used French people instead of Danes. And by the way, all of them were Caucasians. I know there are people of different ethnicities living in France and Denmark, but they focused on what they called Northern European ethnic, which basically means Caucasians. So in France, what they did was said, let's do a dietary experiment. Because they gathered all these obese and overweight French subjects and basically had them all sign a statement. We're going to do exactly what you ask us because of the dietary experiment. And the problem is, with a lot of these studies, people cheat. And so they had all these French subjects sign a statement where they're guaranteeing they would not cheat in the study. So, but they're also smart in saying, we're only going to run the experiment for 12 weeks. You can probably go 12 weeks without cheating on your diet, right? That was kind of the principle.
They suspect the Danes of cheating?
Well, this is done on the French. I don't know about the Danes. I mean, I'll tell you what they said at the very end in terms of doing future experiments. But what they noticed is they surveyed these French overweight and obese individuals about their dietary habits. And then they analyzed them for whether they had a high gene count or a low gene count. And what they discovered is the low gene count individuals were eating less fruits and vegetables and fish products than the high gene count. So they said, let's do an experiment. And the experiment was they put the all of them on what they called an energy-restricted diet. Translation, you're not going to get as much food to eat as you want. You're going to be getting, it's a calorie-deprived diet. And so they put them on a calorie-deprived diet for 6 weeks. Then they followed that with 6 weeks of what they call the stabilization energy intake, which means they were given just enough food to maintain their weight so they wouldn't gain or lose. Then at the end of the 12 weeks, they did another analysis. Well, what they discovered is all those who had a low gene count saw their gene count rise substantially. So the gene count went up. Those that had a high gene count, no change at all. So the diet made no impact on those who had a high gene count. But those who had a low gene count actually saw their gene count go up. And so they concluded this by saying, we think that doing therapy to boost people's gene count could be a huge step in the direction of dealing with the obesity issues. And also what they discovered is that you know, this high gene count actually has certain health markers. And I wasn't aware of this, and probably you're aware of this, Richard, that when you're on, quote, what's called an obesity track, where your weight is going up at a fairly significant rate, it's accompanied by a lot of cardiovascular issues. One thing they found out is that if you've got a low gene count, it's going to send your LDL cholesterol up and your HDL cholesterol down, your triglycerides up, and those are all bad markers for cardiovascular conditions. And they also noted that inflammatory disease orders go way up with a low gene count. Cancer goes up with a low gene count. And then insulin and diabetes, intolerance and diabetes goes way up. So they said instead of looking at people's overall health as a marker for these, morbid conditions, they said we need to be looking at the gutturial gene count. That's actually a more reliable marker of whether a person's at risk for cardiovascular problems. And they said the biggest difference they found between the low gene count and the high gene count was inflammatory issues. So, you know, the whole range of inflammatory diseases, gut diseases, joint diseases, etc. People had a low gene count. They noted that they had in their gene count the bacteria that are basically classified as pro-inflammatory. In other words, they're going to encourage inflammatory disorders. Whereas those with a high gene count had bacteria in their gut, which basically are going to be a help in relieving you of inflammatory disorders. And also as a suggestion, maybe these inflammatory conditions are related to these other health issues. Yeah.
I lost it. Is gene count the same as bacterial species, or what is that?
Well, it's a proxy, basically. I mean, they're trying to find some easy way to try to measure this. And so basically, they're looking at a segment of all these bacteria in the gut and counting the number of genes. To give you an idea of the difference, They found 640,000 genes in the part of the genome that they sampled for the high gene count individuals, and for the low gene count was 380,000. So there's a huge difference between the two groups.
Are these bacteria, was that much difference in genes in the bacteria? What genes are we counting?
Well, they're looking at 58 different bacterial species in the gut.
Okay.
And what they're trying to do is find some way to measure the presence of these bacteria, because you know, some individuals don't have all 58. But so for some of them, those bacteria are completely missing.
Right.
And then for others, they're there, but they're there at a low abundance level. And so they came up with a diagnostic tool to roughly measure the quantity and diversity of bacteria in the gut. But if you read the reports, they found that there was 8 bacterial species that factor most significantly in terms of these morbidity issues like insulin intolerance, diabetes, cancer, cardiovascular, inflammatory issues. And so there was 8 that factored quite heavily in the difference between the two population groups.
Tell me a little bit. When I think of genes, I think of a gene with a genome. I think of it within a cell. And so when I talk about gene count, I'm thinking of probably counting a stalk.
These are not whole genome studies. They're basically looking at a portion, but trying to, and again, they're trying to find some quick and easy way to get a measure of the abundance and diversity of gut bacteria that humans have. And basically, they end both research studies by saying, we think we've found something really significant, but this is just the start of what needs to be a major research effort. The people who did the dietary work said, you know, they made no mention of what foods made up the low calorie portion. So they made the point that it'd be good to do an experiment. Okay, we obviously know that taking in too many calories is a problem, and it seems to help if we actually restrict the calories, but probably what's going to be more significant is what you eat, not how much you eat.
So when they talk about gene count, this one gene, let's say gene A, could be found in bacteria 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5.
Or it might not.
Or it might, and so they're actually looking for a particular type of gene across bacteria.
In some cases, yes. In some cases, no. I mean, okay. Well, you should be confused. because, again, they kind of end the reports by saying, you know, this is kind of a quick and easy way to get a picture of the abundance and diversity of bacteria in the gut. Obviously, it'd be a good idea to develop more comprehensive and sophisticated diagnostic tools, but this is a tool we're able to, and after all, this is a study that's been going on for 9 years. And therefore, you got to take it back to the technology that existed 9 years ago. Today, it could be done with much more comprehension, but also be much more expense. And so, this is basically a proof that this kind of research will be productive for dealing with major health issues. But what got me excited as a Christian, it's also proof there's a lot more to the design of the human body than just what makes up our human body.
Well, I'll leave it at this question and move on. But I would think, well, we have 8 bacteria that are treating people in some way with rheumatoid tendencies and so forth. So we've counted those bacteria. Why are we even counting genes?
Well, okay. What they did is they took a big segment of the genomes of these different bacteria and counted them. And some of them overlap. They'll be found in more than one bacterial species. And again, I want to remind you, this is a study that had to be based on technology that was available 9 years ago, not what's available today. And so this is basically a proxy for the diversity and abundance of bacteria. Now, could it be done with more sophistication and with more accuracy? It certainly could.
Oh, maybe here's my answer that I can answer for myself, that bacteria back then, and maybe still, are hard to identify other than by their genome. Period.
Yeah, I mean, different bacteria. I mean, and see, today we actually have a whole bunch of bacteria where we've measured the entire genome.
Mm-hmm.
But what they're doing is they took a sample of the genome of each bacteria and try to do a cross-spectrum analysis of the bacteria in the gut. Now, frankly, I still think it's a worthwhile diagnostic because it's fairly easy and straightforward to perform. But could it be done with more sophistication? Certainly. And I'll tell you where the paper ended. They said, where we think research should go is on these dietary experiments. And just seeing, okay, let's vary the diet, vary the length of the diet, because what they noticed was, yes, they got a jump from a low gene count to a higher gene count, but it didn't come up to the high gene count average of the second group. But they said, we only had dietary restriction going on for 6 weeks. What if we ran it for 6 months? Or what if we ran it for 6 years? And what if we actually vary the diet to see what works best? And one thing that that is in the paper is they said they've already noted that people with the high gene count typically eat more fruits, vegetables, and fish products. Okay, but it'd be a good idea to figure out which fruits and vegetables and fish products actually get the best results. And so they didn't even come up, they came up to a little bit less than halfway from the low gene count to the high gene count with this 12-week dietary intervention. Now, from my perspective, that's impressive that you've got that much of a result in just 6 weeks of dietary restriction and 6 weeks following of, dietary stabilization. There was no factor of exercise in here. May that be another thing to research. But the bottom line is this. It looks like what these people have demonstrated is maybe a way to really benefit the health of the human population is to look at the microbiome rather than the human body. And the other thing that was right at the very beginning of their paper, clearly obesity is related to our urbanized sedentary lifestyle. Maybe changing that could have an impact on the gene count. And basically they pointed out the problem with modern civilization, the cheapest foods to eat are what they call energy-dense foods. I mean, it's cheap to get food, say, at McDonald's as opposed to going to a health food restaurant. You're going to pay, what, 3 times as much, 4 or 5 times as much to get less energy-dense foods. And again, what kind of less energy-dense foods? Hey, we're having our potluck on December 1st. We could do an experiment, right?
No.
Go ahead.
Okay, two points. Generally speaking, one, wouldn't this be a good argument for a good probiotic? Two, on caloric restriction, wouldn't this also argue well for the use of a good resveratrol? So those two points.
Well, this is really interesting. For example,
resveratrol does mimic caloric restriction.
Yeah, well, we'll see. I mean, this is kind of where this research is going. I mean, this is a very preliminary result. It's a dramatic result, in my opinion, and maybe we could push it all the way from a 40% jump from low gene count to high gene count, go all the way to 100%, and maybe there's something else in that high gene count that we're not yet seeing. So, but what it tells me is when God designed human beings, he designed the microbiome to go with. And something about our modern lifestyle is damaging our bacterial gut species. So they also made reference to antibiotics. And because, there's a concern that if you take antibiotics, that's going to damage your gut. What was a surprise, though, is they discovered that when you do take antibiotics, it tends to go after the bad bacteria that make up the low gene count population and actually helps people that are in the low gene count, but it's bad for people that have a high gene count. So what they're pointing out is maybe you need to analyze your gene count before the doctor prescribes any antibiotics for you, because it impacts people with a high gene count differently than those with a low gene count. Yes?
Did they indicate whether they thought any of this was hereditary?
Yes. That was at the very beginning of their paper, because there's been a whole lot of research on looking for genetic markers for tendencies towards obesity, and they found some. But the significant levels are down at a level of about 2%. So there's a very low correlation. And that's what actually stimulated this study. They said we're finding a very weak correlation between genetic markers, so-called genetic markers for obesity propensity, and people actually becoming obese. They said, let's look at the microbiome genomes to see if there's a stronger correlation. That's probably the most significant part of the paper, is yes, they found that. High correlation if you look at the genomes of the bacteria in our gut, whereas you look at the genome of the human body, there's a very low correlation. It is there, but it's a very low correlation. And again, the whole point is here that we need to thank God for a microbiome that's amazingly designed, all these different species that God put in our gut. So when you celebrate Thanksgiving, that might be something you want to thank God for, is all those gut bacteria you have.
When I have dinner, when I have lunch on weekends, I always have salad, of course. I eat my salad first, the vegetables second, the meat third, and the potatoes, whatever.
And the probiotics last.
The probiotics last. There you go. Well, I'm not recommending any kind of diet here. Neither are these papers. They're basically saying, and I noticed they're quite ambiguous to what made up this low energy diet. So that's kind of the next step. Let's look at different kinds of low energy diets and see what's happening. And by the way, for what it's worth, I'm on what you would call a high energy diet. I eat a lot more calories than people normally eat, but I also eat foods that are very low density in terms of the caloric intake. So you can eat 4,000 radishes and get the same food value as four Big Mac hamburgers. Well, they've done experiments on mice where they had them exercising a lot and giving them all the food they want. Fuzz has written articles on this where he points out that you always benefit from a low-calorie intake. But from a human perspective, a low-calorie intake means that you don't have a lot of energy to do things either. And that's something they noticed with the mice. If you put mice on a low-calorie diet, they become more lethargic. So, and again, that's kind of where this research study is going. Maybe it's not so much focused on the energy in your food as what kind of food you're eating and how dense the energy is. I mean, a chocolate bar, for example, is high energy density as opposed to eating a dozen radishes. So, or broccoli or whatever. I'm kicking back on this broccoli kick. Anyway, for those of you who want the scientific details, it's going to come out in our magazine in the first issue for the 2014 year. So you'll see the details there, yes.
Is it true that the all-fruit diet is very popular in West Hollywood? I'm sorry I said that.
Well, you know, one of the big challenges was this guy was from Hollywood, and we were going to have to entertain him at our house. And by the way, we were told by his friend, you know, so-and-so is a fruitarian. I'd never heard the term before. A fruitarian is somebody who only eats fruit. And we could tell he was a fruitarian when he showed up at our front door. The guy was as skinny as a rail. His skin was very discolored. And so Kathy was talking to me and saying, okay, he only eats fruit. It's very difficult to get much protein into your diet if all you eat is fruit. So she had me do a little bit of a study, and I thought, well, strawberries have seeds in them with protein. And when you eat the strawberries, you actually metabolize the seeds. So he bought him a whole lot of strawberries. I mean, that's one way to get some protein into the guy. Because most fruits, you got virtually zero protein content. You know, we got him some bananas, but there's not a lot of protein there either.
About avocado?
Well, that was not on his list. So, when we had him over for dinner, we just said, you know, how long have you been on this diet? And he said, 2 years. And I said, well, just from our perspective, I'm wondering you're damaging your health by eating only fruit. He was insisting that was the way to go. So, anyway, by the time he left our house, he was actually thinking about broadening his diet to at least include vegetables and not just fruit. So, no, first time I've ever talked to a scientist.
No questions or comments. When I'm standing back here, that's the clue that you're not supposed to raise your hand.
All right.
If people are raising their hands, you know that rule.
Stand
so, no more questions, no more comments, and it's time to
all right, let's get at least a little bit into why we like frozen water. No? We're done? All right, time to pray. Well, Father in heaven, we want to thank you for the amazing way you've designed the human body, Lord, the skeletal features you've given us, the cardiovascular system that allows us to have four times as many heartbeats as other warm-blooded mammals. And Lord, because of that, we can live several decades, and not only live several decades, but live those decades at a high activity level. Thank you, Lord, for the amazing bodies that you've designed so that we could actually enjoy life for that period of time and use that life to fulfill the purpose for which you created us. Lord, I pray, Father, we'd all be committed to using our amazing bodies and the great health you've given us to fulfill your purpose. Lord, that we would be all active in taking the good news of salvation through Christ's sacrifice on the cross to all the people groups of the world. Thank you for giving us the bodies to do that. Thank you for giving us the technology that allows us to take that good news to so many people in such a brief period of time. And Father, we also want to thank God for the amazing ecology of our bacterial gut that protects us from the typical diseases that shorten lifespans. So Lord, we are grateful for this research that's ongoing. We pray you will bless these researchers that they may uncover even more evidence for supernatural, super intelligent design in our gut bacteria that gives us such an amazing capacity for long health and well-being. And Father, I pray you'd also give us the motivation to guard and protect our microbiome, that, Lord, we may actually be able to live life as long as you intend at a high activity level, where we're using our activity and our health to fulfill your purpose for each of our lives. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.